Hi, everyone, and welcome to the live fundraising success webinar, Donor Data, the Key to Retention, sponsored by CVS Global. I'm Margaret Battistelli-Gardner, Editor-in-Chief of Fundraising Success and the host of today's webinar. Everyone knows it costs less to retain a donor than to acquire a new one, and knowing as much as you can about your donors can help you keep them involved with your organization and ease the way to retention. And today, we're going to take a look at how the right data can help you look beyond the numbers and figure out why and how donors connect and stay connected with you. But before we get to our, our conversation, and before I introduce our speakers, let me point out a few quick tips on how to make the most of today's live webinar. First, if you have any technical difficulties, troubleshoot by clicking on the help widget at the bottom of the console marked with a question mark, or let us know via the Q&A box. You can also use the Q&A box to submit your questions to today's panelists. We'll be addressing select questions at the end of the hour, but you can send them in at any time. Please turn off any pop-up blockers on your computer so that you can utilize all of the widgets at the bottom of the console. And remember, your console is interactive, so click on the Tips for Attendees widget below to learn how you can customize your experience today. Okay, with that out of the way, here today to discuss today's topic are Kevin Shulman, CEO of Donor Voice, Leslie Monk, Director of Sponsor Care at Child Fund, and Jamie Hines, Chief Marketing Officer at CVS Global. Jamie, why don't we start with you?
All right, Margaret, thank you very much. If you don't know who CVS Global is, I understand we are an outsourcing provider that does a lot of work with nonprofits and have gleaned a lot of insights about the topic here today, and I wanted to share those with you. So what I'm going to do in the beginning of this call is frame up the story from a big picture perspective, a kind of a 50,000 foot kind of a view, but I'll swoop down periodically to give some additional detail and insights. And what I don't offer, Kevin and Leslie will be filling in when they go a little bit later. So the big picture, here's how I will frame it up for you. And you know, at the highest level, I think that the biggest concerns for all of you as folks who work with and for nonprofits is to achieve the mission. You need to do good work. Then you need to prove that you're doing good work. You need to prove the impact. And lastly, getting back to the topic of this call, you need to do as good a job as you can working with existing donors because, you know, to Margaret's point, we know that it's five times more costly to acquire a new donor than it is to get an incremental donation or incremental work with your existing donors. And I am having a little issue with this slide here. And there we go. So I'm going to focus on that third point, which is do a better job working with existing donors. So I'll start with some motherhood and apple pie, kind of the basic blocking and tackling. And I would say that a goal that I would imagine that all of you would have would be to create a lifetime giver. We all know about the donor pyramid, and we want to be able to move people up from occasional donors to more regular donors, then to major givers, and then ultimately someone who would actually leave money as a bequest, a planned giver. And a client that CDS Global has worked with for a long time, the American Heart Association, does a real good job here, I think, and they've got programs specifically designed for each of these stages. For example, maybe you did this when you were a kid, but there's the Jump for Heart and Hoops for Heart events that they do, and those are for children in elementary school who literally raise, you know, dollars. They raise change and send that in as a donation, but they get accustomed to giving, and then they might graduate up to doing a heart walk and use peer-to-peer fundraising to raise money and achieve a goal, and then later in life, they might attend a heart ball and give more major gifts, and then ultimately perhaps become a planned giver and leave money to the American Heart Association in their will. Next kind of motherhood and apple pie thing is create a recurring giver. And lots of studies have talked about this. This one is from Blackbaud, and it says that donors who are set up to give on a monthly basis give 600 to 800% more than annual giving donors. And I've seen studies that take that from 100% more to 1,200% more. But then some of the other studies talk about how these donors are also more likely to stay engaged year over year. And maybe even more importantly, that it costs a lot less for you as nonprofits to work with these donors who are set up as sustaining givers. Then the next kind of obvious thing, I think, is that we want to be able to communicate with, not to, donors. And we want to send information that they want to hear, not what we want to say. And by the way, we want to send that information in a channel that they want to receive it in. So it's about appealing to the donor and using imagery and stories that let them see themselves in the message. Okay, what's the rub? What's the challenge? Why doesn't everybody just do this? So there is a challenge, and there's also an opportunity, and that is around data. And being out on the road, which I am a lot, I recently was at the South by Southwest Interactive Festival and spent some time with the Social Good and Social Business track there, and I have an opportunity to talk to a lot of people with nonprofits. And really, to a person, they say that cohesive data management and technology strategies are one of the biggest challenges. And one of the first reasons is the fact that there are so many sources of data that come in. If you're in a nonprofit, particularly a big nonprofit, you likely have a CRM, but you likely have a data source around online donations, one for offline donations, one for direct mail, one potentially for an advocacy database, maybe an e-commerce site, certainly some kind of customer service data. And not only is that a lot of data, it's difficult to keep each of those silos of data up to date. And then it's even more difficult to keep employees and volunteers trained on all of those different systems. At the end of the day, there are more stats and data points and indicators. You throw social media into the mix, and you end up with what everybody calls big data, and nonprofits are not immune from big data. But there is opportunity here. All right. So looking at the opportunity, I wanted to address three easy things to consider because it is a lot to get your hands around. So three things. First of all, collect data. And I think that this is pretty obvious, and most everybody does, but collect it from as many places as you can, and then aggregate it to the greatest degree possible. Now, I kind of cheated with number one, because that's actually two things, collecting and aggregating, but important and very related. Number two, use data. If you've got it, use it. And it doesn't have to be perfect. It doesn't have to be completely aggregated, but take advantage of what you have. And one of the easiest things to do is to acknowledge donations and do it quickly and tailor your message and appeal to emotion based on whatever data that you do have. And then thirdly, complete the picture. So augment the data that you have so that you can be sure that you really do know who your ideal donor is. And you would be surprised, or maybe not. I'm often surprised when I talk to clients about who their ideal donor is. And they've got a picture that they strongly believe is that ideal donor, and then it turns out that it's actually a little bit different. And we'll get to that here in a minute. Okay. So here's collect and aggregate data. And I've got a slide shot, a screen capture here from an International Rescue Foundation screenshot. And it shows a very good use of online medium to collect information. And they're collecting a lot of different information here. They've got contact information over on the right. They've got ways that you might consider giving it in checkboxes. They've got what issues are important to you, things that could help tailor message. They've got a box at the bottom to actually share a story in free form text, and then, of course, donate and share buttons with lots of calls to action and lots of ways to collect information about donation preferences. But it's important to note that there is still a heck of a lot of appeals going on via paper. direct mail is still the larger source of soliciting information and donations from donors and constituents, and it is amazing for how long we've been using direct mail, how often we squander the information that's available there. And clearly you can have preset fields on a form from which data can be captured really pretty easily to collect really the same information that you saw on the online form. So preferences for how the donation should be applied, contact information in the forms of an address field. You can see someone might even actually write in a change of address. Other preferences and specifications. There are times on some forms with some clients you work for where that there can be things like prayer requests that can be written in. It's important not to miss that stuff because not only does it give you a view to who your ideal donor really is, but it's also important that donations are applied to the pieces of the mission that are important to the donor. And we all know that some nonprofits have gotten in trouble for not applying donations as the donors had asked. We also know, for those of you who work for nonprofits that are distributed with multiple regions and chapters, that it's important to be able to allocate the donation back to the region and chapter that generated it. So lots of reasons to collect this offline data. And then, again, work towards aggregating it back with the online information. Okay, number two, regardless of what data you have, start using it now. And the easiest way to do that is acknowledge any donations that you do receive and acknowledge them quickly and accurately. Let donors know that you appreciate the donation that they made. It means something to you. Use the data that you've received from them so that you can respond in a way that lets them know that you're paying attention. And at the bottom here, there's a bullet point that is really important. It says, ask for another donation. And you may be surprised if you're not doing this now, how effective it can be to ask for a secondary donation that might be for a related or parallel mission. And we have clients who have really tremendous success doing that. So don't overlook that opportunity. Okay, start using it now, and a little bit more detail on how to use it. And this slide shows that, again, we want to appeal to the right brain because most donations come from feeling, from emoting, from seeing themselves in imagery and seeing themselves and hearing themselves in a story that you tell. And there's actually a study that was done back in 2005 that literally shows that campaigns are more effective when they appeal to emotion. And you know, significantly, 31% versus 16% for campaigns that appeal to the rational side of somebody's thought process. And another way to look at it, I've got a quote in here from a guy named Michael Wilson. And Michael is a person that I've worked with recently here at CDS Global, and he spent the majority of his career at the American Heart Association, actually, and was their CIO and chief client officer. And he recently went out and interviewed the CEOs of 50 of the biggest nonprofits, and he wrote this book called The Digital Nonprofit, and it's available on Amazon.com for $4.99 if you would like to buy it, but I'm not pitching Mike's book. What I really wanted was the quote that is here, and what he said was, think of what you want. You are a consumer. You are the constituent who wants something from your nonprofit. Are you looking for the ordinary? No. You're looking for an experience. Any nonprofit that recognizes you, remembers you, and gives you an amazing service experience will win your heart, and it's all about your heart. You'll be loyal to them no matter what. So important words, and I apologize that I'm mixing metaphors from hearts and brains, but I think you get the point. Okay. Third, do even more with the data that you have, so complete the picture. And this graphic here shows a variety of things that can be done. You can, on the left, you can simply acquire information. You can acquire lists if you think you know the full picture. And over on the right, there's predictive response modeling, which gets really sophisticated to help figure out exactly who to talk to and how to talk to them. But what I'm going to focus on is the middle, and that's assuming that you have some data, how you can supplement that data to determine a profile of your donor so that you can speak to them in language that resonates with them. And one of the things that, as I mentioned, is interesting. When I ask people who their ideal donor is, often they are not 100% accurate. And so I'm going to show you a case study of how CDS Global talked to one of our clients who said, yes, we know exactly who our ideal donor is. It is middle-aged women, and they're professionals. And we said, okay, well, let's actually see what it is. So we pulled up their data, and we referenced it across a database of 240 million people in the U.S., 500 lifestyle, psychographic, demographic attributes, and we got a deeper picture of who these folks are. So, yes, they were middle-aged women who were professionals, but now we know really exactly what the average age is. We know that they have some college background. We know that they live in single-family households, that they've got older children. So we're starting to complete that picture a little bit through the household and life stages. But when we started then to look at occupational interests and activities, it gets really interesting because, yes, they're a professional, but they are also a professional in the medical and education fields. And their top five interests are food and gourmet and exercise and gardening and travel and music. All ways that we can supplement the imagery that we're using when we speak to these folks. So you can glean a ton of information, and then it gets even more interesting when we start looking at things like digital, social, banking and credit, internet usage, and you can start to see how to communicate with them, literally what channels and what kinds of appeals to use. So these folks transacted and paid using credit cards primarily, so that's helpful. We see that they are low to moderate internet users, but when they do use it, they use it for shopping. So likely appeals online would work, but it also likely direct mail, more traditional appeals would work based on this kind of a donor. So a tremendous amount of information that should ultimately help make campaigns convert better, have a higher return. And by the way, if you to figure out who your ideal donor is based on this profile, well, then you can always go buy more, and it should lower your cost of acquisition. So to wrap it up from a big picture perspective, number one, make sure you're collecting and aggregating your data. Number two, make sure you're using the data. Number three, complete the picture with the supplemental information. And number four, then enhance your interactions with your donors. Communicate with them in the way that they prefer, both the message and the medium. Create recurring donors, create lifetime donors, and I imagine that when you do that, you will, as a result, get closer to achieving your mission and proving your impact. So that's my part. I really appreciate you listening, and I am going to hand this over to Kevin to give you some more details.
Thanks, Jamie. I'm going to talk about a very specific type of data that you can collect and that you can start using immediately, and it is going to help build out a better donor profile, as Jamie had talked about, and that's a bit of a longer-term play. We're also going to make the case that this data that you can collect and start using immediately can also increase retention. And the good news, given that I took a scan of the attendees, we've got certainly a mix, not surprisingly, of small, medium, and large organizations. This is something that you can do irrespective of size. There are no cost barriers here. There are no scale or database issues here. This can be done and applied. And I'm going to give you some definition, some context, and global illustration. And then Leslie is going to step in with a real-world example from Child Fund with pros, cons, and lessons learned. So the specific type of data that we want to talk about is referenced on this slide, donor feedback. And we are calling that the secret engagement weapon. So definitionally, and just to avoid any label issues here, for purposes of this conversation at least, donor feedback is what we're calling structured listening. We are asking them to provide us with opinions and feelings. So it's attitudinal data, okay? And more broadly, donor feedback is the donor providing us something that they consider valuable, and we only tend to get it if we ask for it. In that context, you could probably argue that donations are a form of donor feedback, and again, we only tend to get those donations if we ask for it. And in this sector, the nonprofit sector, that form of feedback, if we want to couch or categorize donations as feedback, is really where the sector is oriented, and we think there is a big missed opportunity in not assigning more value to donor feedback of the form that is referenced on this slide and that we're going to spend more time talking about. So why bother? And we don't have benefit of seeing the body language and giving folks opportunity to ask the question right now, but we're going to sort of anticipate that there's a why bother sort of question that's lingering, and specifically some of the comments that we have heard from folks when we have these conversations in the sector around this sort of data, this sort of process, and this sort of activity. Okay, and I'm going to go straight at the heart of why bother, provide you with some proof evidence for donor feedback of the sort that we're talking about and the financial impact that this can have and why it is a missed opportunity in that very little of this is being done in the sector. We're going to get very specific and give you things that you can start using immediately. So I do want folks to recognize that that is a part of all this.
Kevin.
Yes.
This is Margaret. I'm sorry. I just want to butt in for just a second. We've had a few people ask if you could speak up.
I can try to do that. I'm talking straight into a handset, so I can go to a yelling mode and see if that works better.
Not too loud, but just a little bit. Thank you.
Okay. So what you see here are results of a year-long test. We've got the test group in blue and the control group in red, all very familiar for those in the direct response sort of fundraising world. And you can see that the test group had a 3x increase in products purchased from beginning of test to end of test. Again, this is a 12-month test. Attrition rate was down 50% for the test group and a 35% increase in profit. So this is a massive success by any standard or any metric. The single item or experience or touch point or variable that was modified for the test group, they were given a survey, an opinion survey, at the beginning of the year. That is the only difference between test and control. Okay? Feedback is a way to, what we know about building relationships, it is a way to demonstrate reciprocity in the relationship, a way to demonstrate that we actually care what they think. And it is a way to create some two-way interaction, or at least the semblance of a two-way interaction, and that we are soliciting feedback and they provide it. We're going to go into more detail on the notion of feedback of the specific sort that we're talking about, and specifically talk about closing that loop. So they give feedback, and then we have a follow-up that is actually tied to and specific to that feedback. But this is proof that the mere act of asking them for feedback, in this case a single survey at the beginning of the year, has a massive impact on lift and performance of the sort that the fundraisers on this call can appreciate. Okay, now this was in the commercial world. We would argue that the only difference or the principal difference between commercial world and nonprofit is mindset, and it's organizational and sort of sector mindset. It harkens back to my earlier comment that the sector as a whole has focused on, to its detriment in our view, a form of feedback that is them giving us money and not nearly enough emphasis on feedback of the sort that we're going to spell out here today. You all, as consumers, I'm sure have been inundated with requests for feedback as shoppers and website visitors. You can't have a hotel stay or a retail experience online or offline where you're not going to be asked for feedback. Even IHOP is in the business of asking you about your pancakes after your Sunday breakfast. Okay? 38% of outbound marketing activity in the commercial world is for customer sat and loyalty, i.e. no ask, versus 1% in the nonprofit arena. So there is some activity of the sort that we're talking about, and Leslie's going to give a very specific example. This is a screenshot of UNICEF in the UK, where we also do a lot of work, and this was in the lobby, their main headquarters in London. They were attempting to get feedback from visitors, which, as you can imagine, is a rather odd mix of folks going through the lobby of a nonprofit. Now, interestingly, this feedback form was not conjured up by the communications folks or the fundraising people or marketing. They actually had no idea this was taking place. And that's one of the problems. To the extent that some of this feedback does occur, it tends to be done in the verticals or the silos or the confines of operations or customer service, which we would take to be one of the illustrations of the mindset barrier. The marketers and the fundraisers and the communicators have not assigned enough value internally in the organization to this sort of feedback, and that's what we're going to hopefully make a case for here. There is some data, this slide and the next slide, they're going to be specific to the world of nonprofit. So what you're seeing, and hopefully, again, making the case for the why bother question that we had raised in the beginning of all this, this is results from a three-minute, we're calling it a loyalty call on this slide, but you can also think of it as a three-minute call to collect feedback. So it was an outbound telemarketing touch. It was scripted very loosely in that there were open-ended questions. It was conversational in nature, and 3 minutes was the average. There was no requirement that it be more or less or at that number, but by virtue of the structure of the script in that it was conversational and we had call parameters, not call script, 3 minutes was roughly the average. There was no ask in here. It was really asking for feedback. How are we doing in the relationship? And this was done early on post-acquisition. And the short summary here is that for a three-minute loyalty call, you get a 33% reduction in attrition. And what you're seeing there are three different acquisition channels, and there is a drop in attrition across all three channels. Okay? But the problem and the reason that a lot of this doesn't occur, or more of it doesn't occur, is that this looks like a cost if we're trying to manage the business vis-a-vis spreadsheet. This is another amalgam kind of a composite set of data that we have managed to cobble together from the nonprofit world. And this is specifically looking at feedback within that donor service channel, which is another massive missed opportunity right now. And I'm going to, a little bit of orientation is useful for this slide. So along the bottom, we have grouped donors into one of four buckets. Starting on the left, there are folks who didn't complain, moving from left to right. Complaint, they issued the complaint, they were verbal about it, whether it was on a phone call or an email, they complained and it wasn't resolved to the donor's satisfaction. Forget what we recorded in the call history on the organizational side. In the third column, we have donors who said the complaint was resolved, and then in the fourth column, it was resolved and done so immediately. And the height of the bar, which is the vertical there, the y-axis, is the retention rate, okay? An unmistakable line. And the point that we're highlighting here is that you get a significant bump in retention just moving people from the very first bucket there of did not complain to the second bucket of they complained and we didn't fix anything. And so the opportunity and the call to action here in the feedback category is to start requesting and soliciting feedback more aggressively in the donor service channel. Even if we elect to do nothing with that information, which is not what we're advocating, you're going to get an improvement in retention. This is the sort of thing that can be done if you're small, medium, or large. You have proportionally a reasonable amount of inbound volume of questions and comments, and yes, they can run from the pedestrian and mundane of wanting to change biographical information or mailing address to more substantive concerns from the donor's perspective. So there's a wide range, but if you factor in inbound volume, inbound touches, they are taking the time to reach out to us, whether it's phone or emailing, and then combining those, it's a pretty good-sized proportion of your file. This is free money if we take advantage of these touches and recognize them for what they are, which is an opportunity to build a relationship, build in feedback, so post-call or post-interaction we ask how we did, and then we act accordingly. So I'm going to put a bit of a framework around all of this after we've hopefully made the case here for why bother. Okay, so donor feedback is about relationship building. And the premise here is that relationship building is actually done at the touch points. Okay? And the process here is really collecting feedback at those touch points to determine how we did and act on it accordingly. More specifically, the process here is about collecting feedback, applying business rules to those that feedback. That doesn't need to be fancy, sophisticated stuff, and then following up. Okay, so going back to the top, collecting feedback, you can administer this via the agent who's taking the inbound call, if we're talking about the donor service world. You can do feedback on forms of the sort that Jamie was sharing in the beginning, whether it's an online form, an offline form, we want to ask feedback. And then you can go through the process. We're going to give you an example on the subsequent slide here about applying some business rules, just common sense logic. If folks respond in a certain way, we're going to put them in this bucket, and then as the third step, based on the bucket that we place them in, which is tied to their feedback, we're going to have some sort of follow-up, okay, which tends to be in two categories of either escalation, which means that we're trying to fix something. So they gave us feedback, and guess what? They had a lousy experience on whatever the touch point was. And then in the second category, we've had a positive experience, and we want to build on that too. The absolute best time to ask for money is not, contrary to sort of the way the business runs now, when the appeal is scheduled to go out in April. That's probably the worst time to ask for a whole bunch of people that you're going to have that appeal. The absolute best time to ask for money is right on the heels of having delivered a great experience. But we never know unless we ask for that feedback. So this is a bit busy, and I understand that you'll get these slides. So I'm going to move through this kind of quickly so that I can hand off to Leslie. But this is a matrix that's worth spending a little time on post this webinar session, so you can process it. But the idea here, and this looks busy, but ultimately we're talking about a 2x2 grid, not very complicated, right? And what we are proposing as the ideal, and there are sort of lesser versions of this that one can. One can enact more quickly, and so there are sort of the crawl, step, walk, and run versions of this. But what you're seeing here is that we're proposing you ask around touch points. So after we've had an experience, it could be online, offline, it could be based on their inbound contact with us or our outbound pushes. We want to try to capture a relational measure, and this is a way to measure the strength of the relationship. We call it commitment, and again, post this session through Fundraising Success, we can provide those questions to you working with Margaret. But the point is, I want to be able to measure relationship strength, okay, which is a more of a long-term measure. So I have folks calling in. We may have a lousy or a positive experience, but the other bit that I need to know or that's useful to know is, they love us or not love us. What you're seeing on the diagnostic measure side is measuring the specificity around the goal or the purpose of that interaction. Okay, and typically satisfaction is not a bad question to ask if we're talking about measuring how did we do just now on this thing, this experience and this touch point you just had with us, right? And then what you're seeing in the middle, all that sort of convoluted text, is nothing more than business rules. And these are very simple and or statements. Okay, you can make some judgments. The point is we're going to bucket people in this case into one of four categories, and then based on the segment that we place them in, we have some sort of follow-up. This can be an automated follow-up. We're going to push an email to these people, or it's going to be a call list, and we're going to work our way through the call list. Okay? But this is the idea coming full circle here. Yes, we want to collect this kind of data. We absolutely want to use it, which is what you're seeing here. And in this case, using it means that we are going to be responsive to the feedback they just gave us, and we're going to act on it. Okay? So now I'm going to hand it off to Leslie, who is going to give us a real-world example from Child Fund.
Okay. Thanks, Kevin, and hi, everyone. And I'll start off by saying, yes, I'm going to do what Kevin just said and what Jamie said earlier. This is a specific example about how we at Child Fund and our sponsor care team, which is what we affectionately call our donor services group, collects transactional feedback from our donors and uses it as a way to deepen and enhance that relationship. And so almost exactly like what Kevin had just described, what we implement here, what I'll talk with you a little bit about, is an IVR-based survey that we do at the end of every donor service call that we would receive into our sponsor care team. We transfer the call into the survey. We collect some very brief data points from the donor if they're willing to leave it. And we do that as a way to influence our service recovery process, which I'll talk a little bit more about. And also because, make no mistake, I would be the first to admit to you that I personally am first and foremost a service professional who is actually avidly and intensely aware that everyone in the building here is a fundraising professional. And so I'm trying to accomplish both of those goals, and I'm trying to give the donor the final say.
Leslie, this is Margaret. Can I just interrupt for a second?
Sure.
We have a few questions asking you to explain what IVR is.
Absolutely. That is our interactive voice response. So if you're in, if you're working with a donor services group or a contact center that's large enough to have an automated answering that's playing a brief message for you at the beginning of the call and helping to route the call to your donor services rep, that's kind of what we're talking about. This is going to be an automated script that's going to invite the donor to press 1 for yes and 2 for no and that sort of thing.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. And so at a really high level, what we're doing with our interactive survey is as soon as a donor would call in to us, they get into our interactive voice response. They're hearing, welcome to Child Fund, thank you for calling, gosh, we're so glad to hear from you, and oh, by the way, we hope at the end of this call you're going to stay on and let us know how we're doing, and we'll appreciate your feedback. The call is delivered to one of our sponsor care team members. They're helping the donor do whatever they're doing, as Kevin mentioned earlier, anything from the very pedestrian to much more complex and intense inquiry. We're going to handle it as we normally would. And then my representative has a way, you know, two different ways to basically transfer that caller at the end of the call. Instead of hanging up, we transfer it in to an automated survey that says, okay, please stay on and answer these few brief questions, and we really want to hear how you feel. When we set up our internal process, set it up with an expectation that we would exclude certain kinds of interactions because they just weren't appropriate for this kind of experience. So if we're notifying a child sponsor that the child they were sponsoring has died, for example, no, we're not going to talk about that. If it's a supervisor escalation call, well, that's already in recovery mode, so probably not the right time. But we kind of set those parameters in advance. And then once you get into the survey itself, it's really light. It's really straightforward. We target the ability to easily complete it within 60 to 80 seconds, listening to, thinking about, and responding to every question. And the vast majority of it is centered around the experience you just had. How satisfied were you with the call you just had with our representative? And how helpful and friendly was that representative to you? In the services world, the ubiquitous first contact resolution question, essentially, was your question or issue resolved, yes or no? And then we take a step back with the donor and ask them just some general water temperature questions around how they're feeling about Child Fund overall in general. Do you like us? How are you feeling about us? Are you feeling pretty good? And we take the aggregate of those results and we use it as part of our recovery process. Now, again, why do we even bother doing any of this? Well, as Kevin illustrated before, we know we're going to get brownie points just for asking for the feedback. It actually helps give us a lift and provides reciprocity in the relationship, and so we want to do it just on general principle. But also from a services perspective and really illustrating how donor services contributes to fundraising's efforts, we want to be able to show donor-centric measures out of our service team, and we want our agents here to understand how they're impacting donors on a regular basis, and we want the rest of the organization to understand how we are. And most importantly for us, it's that service recovery opportunity, and what I'm calling service recovery here is essentially our ability to mine those responses that come in via our interactive survey and do that in real time and multiple times throughout the day, act upon that. And so I literally have resources set aside in my team that is going to mine that information intraday, during the course of the day, multiple times, and they're going to look for two basic buckets. the first bucket they're going to look for is the group of folks that said everything was swell, and we got very high ratings overall. And those guys we aggregate together, and we send out a thank you, and we so appreciate you spending the time, and how cool are you, email out to all those guys and make sure that they know we appreciate them taking the time. And the other big thing we look for at more regular intervals throughout the day are the people that were unhappy. Either they gave me a low satisfaction rating or they told me no, their issue was not resolved. Those guys, we immediately jump on. We look up what's going on with that donor, and we try to assess how we can get things back on track. And we're going to follow up proactively with that donor to provide a recovery experience to make sure that everything is working for them as they expect it. Doing this at all also provides me a lot of operational benefits. Your manager, your operations manager in donor service ought to love something like this because it's going to give them the fringe benefits of having another very valuable way to coach at the individual representative level how those guys are performing and how those guys are doing. It gives me a way to validate and to measure my quality monitoring process. So we normally listen in, right? You listen in on calls. You see if they're meeting your internal standards of what good is, but it doesn't really matter at the end of the day what your internal standard is if it doesn't match up with what the donor believes good is. So I get a way to validate that. And for me personally, an additional operational benefit was allowing me a way to set aside a service recovery resource and actually create a career pathing opportunity within my donor services team, which has done a world of difference for team morale and providing exposure and just creating a career path. The positive outcomes that I've gotten for this have been numerous, and we continue to kind of – we've only been doing this process for a little less than a year, so we're still trying to look at the you know, the more long-term play. Kind of Kevin showed you some examples of a long-term play of how these kinds of interactions can aggregate over time. But what I know just – from a basic service and operations perspective, is that I've been able to implement process improvements in how donor services runs our department, how we interact with our partner departments, and how we provide a good experience for donors. I've got my donor resolution specialist actively involved right now on a cross-functional task team looking at some organizational policies and making some recommendations on how maybe we can improve it based on the feedback that we're getting from our donors. We use this as a way for doing agent training and refresh. Up to and including part of our recovery scan is to take a look at whatever donor said they weren't satisfied, and if the issue is relatively straightforward, we'll actually get the originating rep to be the one to provide the correction and do the follow-up with that donor. Not only does it show great accountability to the donor, but it actually is the best way for that agent to learn from the experience. And what we're most happy about is our resolution rate with recovery. So what this is saying is that 93% of the donors that we address through our recovery process, through this listening post of this transactional survey and through other listening posts that we've set up in our processes, 93% of them, we can go back and look a month later, 2 months later, and see that they're actively still contributing to us. They're still engaged. We also know that we have an improved win rate with these donors. And at Child Fund Sponsor Care, we affectionately call these wins for children, but they amount to any time we can increase and engage the interaction with our donor in a financial sense. So we can move a donor to an automated credit card donation versus waiting for the next check to arrive, or we can upsell them for an incremental donation or move them to a different fundraising product, or we can even better save the sponsorship in this case, or save the contributor, someone who said they didn't want to continue with us but by the end of the interaction they said they would. And what we find is that in these service recovery situations, I experience almost twice the rate of wins in those interactions as I do with just normal first contact into our donor services team. Just illustrates the point to me that we all know that if you have a situation where the donor is frustrated and we are able to fix it, you're actually going to walk away from that experience with a more engaged, more loyal contributor. Some of the things that we've learned from the experience is that it is absolutely worthwhile for us to invest in service recovery. We've done that from a people perspective and a technology perspective, but I would argue the investment could be nothing more than just putting some time and attention into it with the tools that you already have. And the big thing that you can do to help yourselves in making it successful is to follow up quickly. This is not done on the order of days. This is done on the order of hours in order to be most successful. Absolutely, as Jamie had mentioned earlier, that you want to plan for integration, being able to use this data across everything you know about the donor, and that's the piece that we continue to evolve and work on. And the process overall in general can't just be a set it and forget it. It's something that you can put out there, you can watch, and you can evolve it over time to make sure it's the best experience itself that it can be. So that's our example of how we do it, and let me hand it back to Margaret to take us home.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. I remembered to unmute. It took me a second, but last time I didn't unmute until I got the warning. Please unmute. So anyway, I'm here. Thanks, everybody. That's all great information, and we have a ton of questions. So I'm going to try to get to as many of them as we possibly can, and figuring out where to start is the tough part. We do have a lot of questions about surveys. People really want to know the best ways to do them. And one of the questions that came up is, does it make sense or is it counterproductive to offer some sort of award or premium or something to get people to fill out the survey? Does that, is there a possibility that that could skew some of the results? And does anyone have any experience with that?
Margaret, hi, this is Kevin. As a matter of course for our business, we're working with clients and they wind up doing a lot of surveys, but both of the sort that we talked about here today, specifically these very short scripted feedback type loops that are tied to touch points and interactions, but also point in time kind of strategic surveys where it's a random sampling. On the issue of incentives, we, as a matter of course, typically don't offer incentive. When we do, we would recommend the incentive not be financial in nature, ideally, that it's tied to some sort of branded thing, and that, the premium goods fall into that category. But more often than not, it's actually not necessary. So it is not something you need to think you have to incur that cost in order to get this done.
Is it in any way counterproductive? I mean, do you think that it may skew people's results and opinions if they're filling out the survey basically to get the premium?
Not in a way that you're gonna have some radically different answer. I mean, if the offering is informational in nature, or if it's some sort of branded item that makes sense, that's consistent with kind of the relationship, you're in reasonable shape. Now, there is broader evidence to suggest that, the use of incentives, whether it's in a survey form or in direct response, actually undermines the intrinsic motivations. So all of a sudden, you have unintentionally kind of shifted the rationale and the motive. Now, is that going to change the response in the survey? We haven't really seen that, but it's something to think about more broadly than just the survey world, is the use of those premiums.
Leslie, is that something that you guys have done?
For our transactional surveys, no, we don't offer that kind of motivation or incentive. It's really, the motivation is, do you want to help us out and let us know how we're doing? We have, for larger, broad-based surveys, offered a Child Fund branded token of appreciation, and we've gotten positive feedback on that in the past.
And we also have a few questions about what kinds of questions should be included on these surveys to get the most useful information. And people are asking for specific examples of the types of questions that you would include on the survey to get really useful information.
Yeah, Mark, this is Kevin again. I mean, well, you saw what Leslie asked, and those weren't just randomly identified, right? I mean, they were in two ways, and Leslie can speak to it more specifically, but they were tied to the touch point and specifically the goal of the touch point, not so much the organizational goal, but what was the donor's goal? So that first call resolution is kind of the industry jargon that gets used, which is, as Leslie pointed out, did we get your issue or concern addressed today? That's the donor's goal, and we want to be able to ask that question. And that question doesn't make sense for other touch points. So the kind of the transactional questions or the diagnostic questions really need to be tied to channel and touch point and the donor's goal as much as the organizational goal. So on the website, for example, overall satisfaction with the visit, did they find what they were looking for? Those questions are appropriate in that category. For outbound pushes, whether it's telemarketing or direct marketing, it's a fundraising ask. We would argue it is still worthwhile on the response or reply form, whether it's online or offline, to ask a question about the communication and did it hit on message X, for example, and was it a positive experience or an easy process if we're talking about kind of the online donation form. So those are the sorts of questions you would ask in a fundraising context.
And is there a reason, Leslie, you talked about using an automated survey. And is there a reason why that's preferable over a live person making the call and conducting a survey?
For me, it was kind of twofold. One, there's a cost advantage. If I have somebody else make a call back and do the survey, at least after every donor services call, that can add up. I've done that in past lives. And It's highly effective, but it is a little bit more costly. So I already had this IVR. This is a technology that existed, was at my disposal, and for relatively little expense, I could program it to do this and provide me reports with the information I needed. So it seemed like a pretty natural win. You could just as easily have tried to do it as an email follow-up survey, and I've done that in past lives, in past places, and had success with it as well.
Okay. Jamie, I want to switch over to you. We have a question about retention rates. And do you have any industry standards that you can share about what good retention rates are and what targets you should be trying to hit?
You know, I don't have those at the tip of my finger. I can tell you that we work with a wide range of different nonprofits, and I could actually probably compile some primary information and would be willing to share that if someone wanted to reach out to me directly after the call.
Okay. Anyone else have any insight on that off the top of your head?
Well, Margaret, I'm sure you've seen some of those reports that get published, and whether it's the AFP or some of the Blackbaud work. I mean, first year retention tends to be in the 30% ish range, right? Mm-hmm. And multi year retention can be as high as 60 or 80%, and then kind of the high watermark that we've seen on first year retention is closer to 40, and high watermark on multi year retention is in that upper 80 range.
Mm-hmm. And this certainly sounds like a story that we can put together for either today in fundraising or fundraising success. So I guarantee you we'll be getting back to all of you about that. So now we have a bunch of questions about making second asks, and some of them are coming in about whether or not it's advisable to make a second ask with the thank you. And some people are saying, you know, we hear that this is a good thing to do, but on the other hand, we hear it's a major no-no. Would anyone like to talk about that and whether or not it's preferable?
Well, this is Jamie, and we have seen our clients who have adopted this with some thinking and potential concern almost to a client receive positive results. And when I say that, that's in terms of incremental donations that they wouldn't have received otherwise, and lack of negative feedback from their donor base. So from our perspective, we've seen good things come from it.
Leslie, do you have any insights on that?
I would say that it's something that our donors tend to respond pretty positively to. It's actually an exercise that we do regularly.
Any reason to think it's not a good idea? A I'll take that as a no. Okay. I have a question. It's addressed to Jamie, and I'm going to make sure that I'm reading it right. When you recruit recurring donors, do you eliminate mailing them solicitations?
So that is something that, again, varies by client. And, we work with a bunch of different clients with varying degrees of sophistication in their campaigns. Really, to a client, nobody has as many recurring donors as they would like to have, and they're all striving for that. But when they do, I think that the ones who use multiple channels effectively are the ones who might have a recurring donor. And when they solicit via another channel, as long as they acknowledge that, hey, we appreciate you being a recurring giver, a sustaining member, or whatever vernacular they use, they acknowledge that and say, but here's something extra that we're trying to do for some incremental campaign or mission or event. And I think that that can be really effective. I think it reinforces the fact that you know who your donor is, and it lets them know that they're valuable and that they can, you know, hopefully help out more.
Anyone else like to add to that?
This is Leslie. I would just say, mm-hmm. Child Fund, we have a large number of recurring donors. Our sponsorship model is based on a recurring contribution. And we very regularly find opportunities and use opportunities to, one, educate our donors on other ways in which we're providing services to children around the world and offer them opportunities to participate in those. And those are indeed successful.
Okay. And we have a question about the size of the database. And the question specifically is, what size of database is necessary to do some computer modeling that would allow me to identify predictable giving patterns on specific groups? And the person who sent in the question said, I've been told that there's a minimum size required for it to be reliable.
So we didn't really get into predictive modeling here.
Mm-hmm.
I would say more on the profiling side, looking at the size of the database there, the number of psychographic and demographic and lifestyle attributes that you have is clearly going to give you a richer picture of your donor database, regardless of the size of the donor base that you start with. And even without talking about the predictive piece, I think that there's a tremendous amount of value if you have, you know, from a few thousand donors to, you know, hundreds of thousands of donors in supplementing the basic information that you have even before you start to think about predictive modeling.
So, it makes sense that no matter what size the organization is, it should be collecting donor information as much as possible and using it, as you said in the beginning.
For sure, regardless of the size, collect it, aggregate it if possible, because you're gonna glean a much more well-rounded picture of who you're appealing to, and then supplement it with readily available data like the kind that we provide.
Kevin, did you want to add anything to that? Talking about, you know, how data collection and usage can vary based on the size of an organization and what maybe smaller organizations should be thinking about in terms of all of this.
Yeah, well, I think at least on the feedback of the sort that you know, Leslie and I were talking about in detail, that is that there is no barrier to entry for that sort of activity, and it is in a lot of ways taking advantage of existing touch points. So the incremental amount of work required to think about and add in some sort of feedback script tied to that interaction, again, whether it's a push or they're inbound, it is very incremental, and then acting on that feedback that we get, whether it's a manual process or a more automated process, again, we've got sort of incremental efforts to take advantage of the existing touch points. That's the way I would think about it, and therefore there really aren't these scaling barriers where you've got to be of a certain size in order to get into this game.
Okay. I'm sorry. I have so many questions coming in. I'm having a hard time keeping up with them. I guess we're actually getting very close to the end of the webinar. So can each of you take a very quick minute and not even a minute, seconds, and tell us the top takeaway that, our attendees should leave this webinar with very quickly.
Well, I'll start this up first, and, I think that you know, I laid them out there in, points 1, 2, and 3. Collect the data from as many places as you, can. Pull that data together as best as you can. Use whatever you have now to appeal to emotions, and then start thinking about supplementing that data so that you can learn who your ideal donor really is, not who you think that they are.
Great. Kevin?
Yeah, I would say, you know, crawl, walk, run on this, but start crawling instantly. And so in the category of feedback, pick a channel, pick it today, pick a, touch point, so whether that's donor service or your online form for donations or some outbound reply form. Think for a moment about the goal of the donor, not the organizational goal. Ask a question about whether or not that goal has been achieved from the donor's perspective. Start with that. You can just start with asking the question and collecting the data. As we made the case, you don't even have to act on it, and you're going to get some lift and some benefit. So just get into the game sooner rather than later.
Okay. And Leslie, really quickly.
I would say what the gentleman said.
Nice. Okay. Well, we are absolutely out of time for today. But before we wrap up, I'd like to take a minute to mention our Engage conference, which is happening in Philadelphia on April 10th. Please check out the site for the conference and consider joining us for this intensive case study focused conference. It offers an in-depth look at the growth strategies of some truly effective organizations. Now, on behalf of Fundraising Success and CDS Global, I want to thank you for attending the webinar. I want to thank our speakers and our sponsor. Please be sure to check out our webinar page to get information on all of our archived and upcoming webinars. And if you would just take a minute to fill out the brief feedback survey that is on your screen, we'd be really grateful because your feedback will influence the webinars we bring to you in the future. Have a great afternoon, everybody, and thank you.